over on 91.9 FM and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up this morning on KBOO, next it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener commentary. At 9 on alternative radio, environmental activist and feminist Anna Shahnaz Aryan speaks on the Armenians fed up with that country's injustices. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on stage and studio, D-May features the Third Rail repertory production, Men on Boats, a play about 10 explorers, all played by women. And at 11:30, Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews Hannah Piper Burns about her installation, Venus Retrograde, based on the TV series The Bachelor. Coming up next, it's Abe and Joe.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
For decades, KBOO News and Public Affairs has welcomed radical and spirited activists to share their actions in the Northwest and beyond. KBOO is central to connecting the world to what is happening in Cascadia. We put the mic in everyone's hands. Help amplify the stories of people in your own backyard. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Well, I'm going to cut the music short.
Well, you can do that. You're one of the hosts.
I'm almost as powerful as you. And I want to remind people that they should listen to KBOO 90.7 FM. That's what you're listening to right now. This is the Abe Proctor and Joe Uris show. Mm-hmm. That's Abe Proctor. Yep. I'm Joe Uris, I think. And the number to call to be on the air is 231-8187. But wait, I have a small lecture to deliver.
Oh, God.
Well, you said...
I'm going to check my email.
You always said, tell people about tariffs. I'm going to tell people.
Okay.
If that's okay.
But why? Why are we telling
people about tariffs? Because the crazy-in-chief is suddenly, without any warning, without any discussion, without any prompting from anybody except his mad mind and Fox News, decided that what we need to do to deal with an alleged imbalance in trade is have tariffs. And he says that tariff wars are easy to win. And he's out of his you-know-what-kind of mind, the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States, the one with the fake hair thing and other things.
Right,
right. You know, that guy.
Ooh. So tell us about tariffs.
Okay, let's talk about tariffs. This is a very short history. I'm not going to spend a long time. Alexander Hamilton was the first big advocate of tariffs.
In history?
He did three.
Nobody invented the concept of tariff before Alexander Hamilton.
No, Alexander Hamilton was the first American guy to push tariffs in 1791. And protective tariffs were rationalized in two ways. In one way, and the most important way, they would protect what were called infant industries.
Tariff is a tax on goods.
Yeah, tax on coming from anywhere else.
Okay.
And this was an act of faith. If we can just protect ourselves from cheaper manufactured goods coming out of Europe, in this case, we will be able to grow our own industries, and we will have an internal American economy, which, by the way, was an idea held very strongly by the Whigs and others. Not the tariff itself, but the idea of building an American economy independent of Europe.
So the tariffs raise the price of imported goods relative to domestic goods and provide an incentive for people to buy stuff made in the United States.
Right, particularly when the manufacturing here was somewhat cruder than the manufacturing out of England particularly.
Right.
So, and you got to also understand...
Plus slaves making stuff.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. One of the big things that made the United States a very successful country, the main big trade thing, was the fact that we were great growing cotton. And cotton was grown and handled and picked and worked by slave labor. Meanwhile, that allowed mills to develop, based largely on water power and later on steam and then electricity, allowed mills in New England to manufacture cloth of quality that could rival European clothing goods. And that, in turn, created an internal economy, which later became known as the American system, which was a kind of a notion of an economy totally independent of European markets. However,
and totally dependent on slaves.
Well, yeah, duh. Okay.
All right. I mean, just want to make sure we don't lose that.
Oh, we won't lose that.
Picture. Okay,
we can't lose that. That is a horrible, right. Terrible, real truth. Anyway, so this was a thing that Alexander Hamilton pushed in 1791. The Whiskey Rebellion, by the way, in 1794, was a reaction to one of the first excise taxes. The United States government decided it needed money, so it would tax distilled spirits. Well, the reason why whiskey was being made out of the corn that was being produced in the Ohio Valley and so on was that it's much easier to transport barrels of whiskey than the many, 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 many bushels of corn to the markets in the East Coast, where they would then be turned into whiskey anyway.
So whiskey is all about efficiency. Be efficient, people. Drink your corn.
The whiskey is all about efficiency. And because there was this tariff on whiskey, the farmers had a rebellion called the Whiskey Rebellion, which was put down by an army of 20,000 led by Alexander Hamilton and George Washington.
Hmm.
So, you know, the things were not so peaceful and they were not so kind. And all of this, again, as you pointed out, depended on slave labor in many states. Later, a system called the American system, I mentioned it earlier, but essentially an internal system in which everything that we needed would be produced in the United States. But there was a problem with revenue. And one of the ways to get revenue always is to tax things coming in. So this is a very tempting thing to do. I'm going to kind of jump ahead. I mean, there were a lot of these. In the 1880s, in the Gilded Age, the Republicans took the position, essentially, of high taxes on wool, high taxes on cotton and other things. These tariffs were, in many cases, ruinous for smaller farmers. The McCumber Act of 1922 raised tariffs under Harding and then later Coolidge. I'm not really going to skip a lot here, but I want to make clear one thing. When you had this situation post-World War I, what essentially happened was that trade slowed down and was ruinous for Europe. The deal after World War I was that Germany would pay off the debt that it allegedly owned for making the war. Germany would pay that off to the French and the British, who in turn would repay the United States for our involvement in that war. So here we have an international arrangement paying off for a disastrous and stupid war, and the way in which this is being accomplished in the United States particularly, is to have these enormous tariffs discouraging goods coming from Europe, which was the main market that was a concern here. And there were tariffs in 1922 that were ruinous. There was the Hawley-Smoot tax of 1930, which made things even higher and worse. Earlier, there was the Underwood tax of 1913. Essentially, the result of these ruinous taxes was the creation of a stalled international economy, which in turn, because it stopped all this repayment system, it put enormous burdens on Germany, it created a huge crisis worldwide, and that, of course, led directly to the rise of fascism, which in turn led directly to World War II. So one of the things we do know about high tariffs and tariff behavior is that they can have profound effect. And that kind of an effect could conceivably be repeated, not the rise of Germany as a fascist state, but with all kinds of problems involved. If, for example, we raise the tax on aluminum, which is what Trump off the wall proposed by 10%, that does enormous damage to one of our neighbors, Canada. And if we do that to Canada, they will have no choice but to respond with something else against us. And so it will go. And this is called a trade war.
Yeah.
And Trump says, with his incredible stupidity and Fox News brain, oh, well, trade wars are good, and they're winnable.
Easy to win, he said.
Easy to win. No, never have been easy to win. In fact, nobody usually wins. And it is an incredibly, incredibly terrible way to slow down the economy of the world. The best way, the way we have until very recently moved, is toward an open trade situation where we do protect against dumping. Dumping is the process where goods are sold on the market in America at less than, usually less than their actual cost to produce by countries like Japan, South Korea, and China. That process is illegal and is blocked. And it's not a big problem right now.
No, but it was at one point.
It was.
Japan is a textbook example of this.
Yes.
Prior to the 1970s, most television sets watched in American homes were manufactured in the United States. But through this process of dumping, Japan was able to essentially take over that market.
Right. And then later, South Korea.
Right.
So we can see that that trade policy has an enormous impact on economies, which in turn, let's be very clear, have an enormous impact on jobs.
Yep.
If Philco and RCA, et cetera, are suddenly not making their TV sets, these are brands unknown to people today, are suddenly not making their TV sets here, and they're going to Mexico to do it because labor is cheaper and because there's no blocking of the process, well, American labor lose out. And the argument that Trump is making is that argument. That is, a long time ago, things were done in a certain way. He has a very limited mind when it comes to economic issues. He's a limited mind. I don't want to take it any further than that. But he doesn't really understand that now there's a complex arrangement. There's the European Union with its own set of rules and anti-tariff agreements. In 48, we lowered tariffs. There's an 124 nation organization, the World Trade Organization. It's very important, and it has many agreements limiting tariffs. NAFTA, which is being renegotiated right now, which Trump says is a terrible deal, is in fact a great deal. We are using less expensive labor from Mexico. We are using raw materials from Mexico and from Canada in the United States to produce a standard of living unrivaled almost anywhere in the world.
Did you just make an argument in favor of global capitalism, free trade agreements, and international supply chains?
I am describing the economy. I'm not making
You said it was great. You just described the free trade agreement as a great deal. For whom?
For capitalism.
For capitalism. Oh, for capitalism.
And in turn, for
well, congratulations, for, let me finish,
and
capitalism.
In turn of people being employed in the United States.
Yes.
The argument, the hinge of the Trump argument, is the assumption that American labor has somehow priced itself out of the market because goods are cheaper from somewhere else, which is not really true.
Well, that's so problematic, that argument, on so many levels.
Oh, yeah.
I know, and I don't want to devote the bulk of the show to criticizing the evils of international capitalism.
Well, I'm glad of that. I thought you were going to go there.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to describe this entire situation without doing that, at least to a certain extent. But just concentrating on the issue of tariffs for a moment and leaving aside all the other problems associated with multinational.
Which I was trying to do. I was trying to do that.
Yeah. Let's take the aluminum question, for example. If we impose 10% trade on tariff on aluminum, as you mentioned, our principal supplier is Canada. That has an immediate impact on people who produce aluminum in Canada. And it also has an impact on those people employed here in the United States who make things out of aluminum.
Well, your Pepsi is going to go up.
Well, lots of things will go up. Automobiles, all kinds of things will go up. But the point here is that there are the livelihoods of families who are dependent on whether or not these sorts of things like tariffs exist.
Right.
Now, we can argue all day long about whether or not it's good for the future of the planet to maintain this system of international supply. I'll cut to the chase. No, it's not in the interest of the planet to maintain this system. Nevertheless, the ability of families to feed themselves is dependent on these things.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the the insanity. Well, there are two kinds of things going on. There's the question of whether or not tariffs, high tariffs, will in any way help the economy. That's very dubious. Most economists don't think it's a good idea. Trade wars are usually disastrous. In fact, historically, they have led to world wars.
Yeah, to actual wars.
Real wars. Real yeah. wars. And, you know, it's really clear that this is not a good way to handle inequities among nations. Better to have agreements where prices are fixed based on the markets that exist and build on those. Now, what's weird, and you mentioned it in a way, is that what I'm talking about is capitalism and how it can best survive. I am not discussing the needs, which are very real, for social democracy in a country like the United States, and the necessity of creating shared arrangements in the marketplace that are not built on supply. What is being ignored over and over again in the last few years, including in the Obama administration, is that there are two factors in economic theory: supply, which is all they ever talk about, and demand. And the demand side is very weak at this point. The weird thing is most people have most of the machinery, the technologies that they need. So there's a very weak market for ones that are existent. You have to keep inventing new ones. So everybody gets at Christmas a little old drone of their own.
A little drone for Christmas.
I saw this.
I got a little drone for Christmas.
Did you really?
I did.
Does it fly?
It does.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you drop bombs? What do you do?
No, no. Just
take pictures?
Just fly it around for
fun.
Does
it take pictures?
It could if I put a camera on it.
Yeah. Ah, well, yeah. That's really good. I saw a wonderful video of a guy fishing off the pier in Santa Monica, you know, and he was fishing for whatever you could get out of the Pacific at that location, and a drone was watching, and he flicked his rod, and he caught the drone and brought it down. There you go.
That's a skilled angler right there.
That man knows his vision.
We've got a caller standing by. Before we go to caller, I want to touch on one more thing that you said.
Okay.
I think we need to be careful when we're critiquing global capitalism not to fall into the linguistic framework that's been very carefully constructed for us. You mentioned that American labor has priced itself out of the market. I would argue that American labor has done no such thing. Ownership has taken its capital and gone looking for cheaper labor elsewhere.
Yes, I agree with you. I didn't mean to suggest that the fault lay with labor.
Okay, but that formulation, that phrasing, suggests that the fault lies with labor.
Well,
that,
no.
Oh, if American workers were just a little less greedy, if they didn't want so much money for their time.
If they didn't need housing, if they didn't need food, if they didn't need health care.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'd be much better.
They should just
shut
up and be grateful that the job creators even gave them a job.
Well, really. As Romney once famously said, there are only the people who are job creators and then everybody else.
Right.
So, really, the heart of what is now the Republican Party, and this has not always been the case, the heart of the Republican Party at this point historically is essentially a small group of, I'm going to use their language, takers. Just ugly, vicious takers. And this is something that is well disguised by the pop culture of the ignorant, which is, I have to say, things like Fox News.
I think you inverted it, though. The capitalists call themselves the makers. They are the makers, the creators of stuff and of jobs and of wealth and of everything good in the world. And everybody else who doesn't do this is a taker.
Yeah.
Even those people who work to make those goods.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, a worker.
Yeah. All right. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. I think you mentioned that.
I did. I mentioned
503-231-8187 is the number to call. My name's Abe. That is Joe over there. There's other ways to get through to us. You can reach us at the Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe, and also on the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. Let's go to the phones.
Yeah.
Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. So I'd like to suggest to you that our president may have done us a great favor, not by imposing tariffs or suggesting tariffs, but by telling us that our trade deals are a big giveaway, that they're somehow disadvantageous to our country. And that begs the question of, why would we do that? Is it because our negotiators are incredibly stupid? Or is it because we're an incredibly generous country and we want to give our jobs away? Or is it because there are some domestic interests that are driving our trade deals and driving the Congress to ratify them. And I'd just like your comments on that.
Well, you're raising some interesting points, and I appreciate it. I think that the thing to understand about the situation is multiple factored. Number one, the consumer seeking an equal quality, whatever, blah, blah, electronic equipment or whatever, will look for it at the best price that they can find. And there is, of course, a disparity between wages among many nations and the United States. And this is a grim reality which has an impact all over the world. At the same time that that's true, those workers in those countries are receiving a wage which allows them to survive and sometimes even flourish, even as American workers in the old industries, the old industrial belt, we call it the Rust Belt now in the parts of the country where it has been had its impact, that is an old-time industrial base. More and more of what is economically real today is stuff that is very highly processed, very technically developed, and is not the old stuff. At the same time, there is a huge, huge building boom going on, which involves steel and aluminum in cities like New York and Los Angeles, and by the way, Portland, Oregon, where they're talking about skyscrapers, just like they are in New York. So it really is not, it's really not a situation of crisis, except that, in fact, a lot of workers are unemployed in the United States because their technological skill levels and their wage needs exceed what the owner class wishes to give them in both cases.
And it's important to remember that the owner class will always want to give as little as possible.
Well, it's inevitable. Class. Of course, if I'm going to make somebody mow my lawn, I don't have a lawn, but if I make somebody mow my lawn, I'm going to try to get the cheapest lawn mowing guy who will mow it adequately. And he will be fighting with a bunch of other guys or women who are trying to mow lawns and in competition with him. So the whole process drives the value of the labor to make the lawn down. And the argument then with this with the tariffs is, well, we can make things more expensive that come from somewhere else and therefore protect our workers. But what it really does beyond that, and I'm not sure it even does that, what it really does do is it creates a tax on goods. At the very least, if you have a 25% tax on steel, suddenly your automobile, even though it is being perhaps made by a foreign company in this country and ununionized labor at that, that automobile will cost more because the steel and the aluminum that goes into that automobile will be much more expensive. And since the profit need of the manufacturing class, of the owner class, stays the same, it's going to kick up the price of those goods. And when it kicks up the price of those goods, it makes it marginally more difficult for ordinary people to buy those goods. And when that happens, you get what is known as a depression.
Did that answer your question, caller?
No.
okay, man.
All that's true. But there's a question of the policy process. Why? How is it that we can negotiate trade deals that that Mr. Trump could think of as giving things away, and that asks the question: what whose interests are being served by our trade negotiators, and what are the Senate, the Congress looking at when they approve or don't approve trade deals and treaties?
Well, I'm glad you answered that question because in this particular case, it doesn't appear that these tariffs were negotiated at all. Reporting out of the White House suggests that President Trump implemented these tariffs in a fit of pique, in a moment of anger, in the midst of a tantrum. Here's where speculation begins. Most people seem to think because he feels the noose of the Bob Mueller investigation tightening around his neck. And it's also been reported that he was quite angry recently that the security clearance of his genius son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was reduced. So he's angry, he's petulant, so he decided to implement across-the-board tariffs on steel and aluminum.
Let me finish just one thing. What Abe is saying is that this is a very petty, stupid move. That's
true.
It's not rational. There's nothing rational about it.
Right, that's all true. But I was referring to the NAFTA and the WTO and all that. And when if he tells us, well, those are really bad deals, right?
Yeah.
And I think there are some people who think that maybe the WTO wasn't the greatest deal in the world for the country. Well, why is it that we negotiated that? What whose interests were being served by those treaties?
The ownership class.
Yeah, let's always be clear. In the United States, at this time in our history, generally, there is no liberal left reform movement. There's no drive towards social democracy. So almost anything that happens legally is driven by the interests of the ruling class. I mean, that's just, there's never been a more pure example of that than what has been happening in the United States over the last 20 years.
But Mr. Trump is asking us to have a discussion about that.
No, he isn't.
He doesn't want a discussion.
He wants stupid arguing with stupid.
Right, of course. But when he tells us these trade deals that we negotiated are really bad, well, he doesn't want us, of course, to have the discussion. I don't think he's bright enough to figure out that maybe he's begging the question of, gosh, who is negotiating these
trade deals? Well, there's an assumption underlying what you're saying, which is these trade deals are really bad. I'm not sure that, given the real world, they're really bad. They're not really bad. They have mixed elements. There are some things that are really harsh, particularly harsh and hard on the working class. I agree. But they're not really bad in the abstract meanings of the welfare of the ruling junta, a better term I can't think, who run the United States. That's why these deals are done. That's your answer to your question. They're done because it's in the interest of the ruling class.
Well, I think that it's a legitimate discussion to have.
Absolutely.
Why is policy made in the interest of the ruling class, and how might we want to change that process? That's all I'm.
I think you're raising a very profound and important question, and I'm going to, on that note, move on. Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for the call. I think this is a good time to jump in with another observation. That surprise, the president's not actually dealing with facts as we understand them.
Well, he has alternate facts. Kellyanne world.
For example, tweeted this yesterday. We have large trade deficits with Mexico and Canada. NAFTA, which is under renegotiation right now, has been a bad deal for the USA. Massive relocation of companies and jobs. Tariffs on steel and aluminum will only come off if a new and fair NAFTA agreement is signed. Also, Canada must treat our farmers much better. Highly restrictive, period. Mexico must do much more on stopping drugs from pouring into the U.S. They have not done what needs to be done. Millions of people addicted and dying. I read both those tweets because he connected them with an ellipsis.
Uh-huh.
But the reason I do this is he's not dealing with facts as we understand them. We actually run a small trade surplus with Canada,
right,
our closest neighbor.
Right.
But he's claiming we run a massive trade deficit, and he is unilaterally imposing pretty stiff trade restrictions on them based on nothing that resembles reality.
No,
with no regard for the consequences.
Yeah.
He's a crazy man.
Well, he's a crazy clown. You have a crazy clown in charge. And you have a chicken, and I can't use the last word that goes with that, unfortunately, on the air, a chicken Congress led by a bunch of really, really selfish and ugly people. Paul Ryan, for example, who is opposed, by the way, actually opposes these tariffs. Paul Ryan intends there to be a terrible lack of revenue with his new tax laws, which will allow him to then turn around and say, oh, we've got to get rid of Social Security. We've got to get rid of Medicare and Medicaid. We've got to cut the benefits of food stamps and so on, so that the poor not only will pay more, but will be hurt more. And that's rationalized by the fact that we're going to run deficits, and deficits are terrible.
All right, let's take care of a little business. We'll go back to the phones.
Oh, I think so.
Coming up today on KBOO at 9, alternative radio environmental activist and feminist Anna Shahnaz Aryan, apologies for pronunciation, speaks on the Armenians fed up with that country's injustices. At 10, Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage in Studio D, May features the Third Rail repertory production, Men on Boats, a play about 10 explorers, all played by women. That sounds really interesting.
Well,
at 11:30, Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews Hannah Piper Burns about her installation, Venus Retrograde, based on the TV series The Bachelor. That sounds even more interesting.
I've never found The Bachelor at all interesting. No, I don't know.
Not really interested. There's a whole art installation based on it. I think I might have to go see that.
Okay. Well, I think they do great plays. I think it's worth going to see. But I'm dubious about The Bachelor as a source.
Indeed. And finally, KBOO's Kickstarter campaign is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And while we're on the subject, I would like to thank people who overnight made a contribution to our Kickstarter program. Wynn, Barbara, Peter, Logan, Karen, Naomi, and Aaron, thank you so much. We only have $6,000 left to
Wait,
go.
We only need $6,000?
We only need $6,000.
We only need $6,000?
Kickstarter's goal.
Hey, you out there, give us $6,000.
You know, and I want to mention here also, this Kickstarter is to help KBOO build a city of media makers. What does that mean?
I don't know.
We're going to train people how to be citizen journalists, how to produce.
We're doing that.
We do that. But we're going to teach everybody how to do it, because everybody walks around now with a sound and video production studio in their pockets. There's called smartphones. You should get one.
I'm going to devote an entire show to showing you how that and all of this new technology is a part of a totalitarian effort. I'm going to prove it to you.
Challenge accepted.
Done.
All right.
All right.
Let's go back to the phones.
All right.
George, good morning.
Good morning. I've been listening to both of you, and I think you both really understand what's going on. And there's a
you're mistaken.
But I wanted to say how I've been looking at it, and it's a different way. But I think a lot of it ends up where you've been talking, and it's as powerful financial sources invest elsewhere in the globe, centers of production of, well, steel, aluminum, pharmaceuticals, and, you know, Philco and whatever. I guess Philco may not be around anymore. Television sets and so on spring up. And the capitals compete with each other. Even if they're inside the same corporation, the branch in Mexico may be saying to the branch in, let's say, New York City, we can make whatever it is you're making and sell it for a tenth of the price or a third of the price in New York City, and we're going to run you out of business even though we're under the same corporation. And I've just been thinking about this, and it just seems to me that we're stuck as capital expands, and Joe said it in some ways, we're stuck under this and we have to do the best we can, and Abe said it slightly different, and he started to criticize international capitalism. And I'd say, well, that's the way capital works. It expands, and if you get enough centers, pretty soon you find out they're competing, and they will start doing things to, they'll bless the consumers as long as they need to get the leverage, and they will be treating their workers worse and worse and worse, as you know. So please tell me, is this crazy, or, I mean, is this just another way of looking at it that seems rational?
Well, I don't know how to respond. You're not crazy, and it's not an unreasonable way to look at it. The reality is that money is very fungible. It goes where it can make the best profit.
You bet.
And that's the pattern of capitalism, period. It doesn't look at, well, will this mean that people won't be able to get dental work? Will this mean there won't be any child care? Well, none of that's relevant. What's relevant is who's going to make the money and how much money it's going to be and what they're going to produce to make it. That's all economics really is when you get down to it. And in consequence, the idea of the power of other people, of ordinary workers and so on, really depends on political power.
Yep.
In recent years, since the Vietnam War, interestingly enough, organized labor in abstract political terms has moved not to the left but to the right. And the consequence of that has been to leave it without a strong populist base. And when I say populist, I mean it in the old term, yeah, not in the modern right-wing term. So what really has happened is the working class has been disconnected from its own political power,
yep,
and is largely unaware of that. And that is a terrible situation.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, we have in this country at this time, and in many countries, enormous challenges partially due to the fact that there is a lying mythology that dominates the thinking of many, many people. And that, in turn, is due not only to the fact of capital's influence on media like Fox News, But beyond that, the fact that people in this country and all over tend to be poorly educated in economic issues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I'm going to hang up. I want to hear the rest of this.
Well,
hey, thanks for the call.
That's more than I can say. All right.
Vicky writes into the Facebook page to say, why did Trump start this trade war talk? Because he needs a war for attention. I'm grateful that it's only a trade war as opposed to an actual gun war. It's
well,
a distraction.
Well, I think a gun war is coming.
It could very well be.
I'm sorry, but I'm afraid of
also,
that.
Also, a serious investigator would be looking to where the trader-in-chief might make money from these deals. And it's interesting that Vicky brought that up.
Because
guess what?
What?
You heard of a man named Carl Icahn.
Ah, Carl Icahn. Let me see.
Actually, a
very powerful capitalist corrupt guy.
Yes, a former advisor of Donald Trump.
Right.
Who, about a week before Trump's tariff announcement, unloaded about $31.3 million in steel stock.
Do you think he had advanced knowledge?
Coincidence?
Coincidence? I think not.
But since Trump's tariff announcement,
yeah.
The stock that Mr. Icahn fortuitously sold has lost about a third of its value. So that was a very well-timed move on
his
part.
Well, he's a clever man.
A very
a clever man.
Businessman, Mr.
Yeah, really
Icahn.
Astute. What an astute fella.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Who's next? Mike, good morning. Michael.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, I see the economy developing in a really bad way, which is that there are going to be jobs for high IQ people with tech skills, and everyone else is going to be a drone on some kind of welfare and opioids.
Well, I object to the term high IQ. Technical skills, technical knowledge, usually accompanies... really quickly, is an indication that someone has a brain. I don't think that the profoundness that is characteristic of people who are really intellectually gifted is necessarily consistent with the fact that they learn how to do things.
Well, all I can say is I teach people to write code.
Okay, that's
and
a useful skill.
Some people are not smart enough to learn that. A lot of people are not smart enough to learn that. And, you know, you can say, well, I object to the idea because eugenics, blah, 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 et cetera. It's still true that some people are smarter than others. The average IQ in this country is 100, and you probably need something like 120 to be able to write code. And that's not even, you know, that's a lot less than half the population. What about all these other people who could do great, useful work at things like construction or whatever? Instead, what's happening is everything is being automated and systematized, and there are all these people who basically, the way the economy is configured, there's no use for them in the economy.
Well, I think you're making I think you're making a very good point.
I think you're spot on.
Again, I want to bring up the concept, which I learned in 10th grade, of supply and demand. The fact of the matter is there can't be demand if there ain't wages to buy the stuff. And so we are in a dilemma of capitalism, which has enormous potential impact. And the way it's often solved is to have a war.
Okay, but that's not the point. The point I'm trying to make is different from that.
Okay.
The point I'm trying to make is that we're configuring an economy that has no use for most of the people in this country other than menial, bad jobs. And I think the economy should be configured so that there's a job for anybody in the country. We should make an economy that has jobs for the people we have, not for some theoretical set of people who all have a high IQ and tech skills, because that's not reality.
Well, I agree with you to a great extent.
I agree with them 100%.
Michael,
100%.
Well, here's a first. I want to thank you, Michael. I want to point out that Kurt Vonnegut, years ago, in his science fiction, talked about a society in which many, many people had no real job skills, and they were put into something which was a national program, which was nicknamed Reeks and Wrecks. That is, people who would do the picking up of the garbage and the mowing of the lawns and so on. And it was a society which was divided very deeply into those who were technically skilled and could make good wages, and those who were absolutely dependent on these service jobs that were created within the government structure.
Was that player piano?
I don't remember which one it was.
Because I read one of his books that was player piano, where people eventually rise up against something like that and they destroy it. And then after they've destroyed it, it's really sad the way it ends. You know, they've broken all the machines and everything. And then these people start going, oh, you know what? take this broken piece of this machine and that broken piece of that machine and make this useful thing out of it. And they start doing that, and you see they're taking those down exactly the same path that they just had destroyed.
Well, yes.
You end up with the same automation again.
Well, yeah, that's Kurt Vonnegut in a nutshell. And I think you're right to, I'm not sure which book it was. It's been so long since I read that stuff. Listen, Michael, I'm going to let you go and get some other people on.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay.
That's a great call. One of the deep ironies about this techno-dystopian economy that Michael just outlined for us is that in addition to this this skilled class of technocrats who will have well-paying, decent jobs, and the masses of unskilled workers that he describes, you're also going to have this ownership class that's not particularly skilled in and of itself, but enjoys power, wealth, and status based on the fact that they own a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And they will inevitably, they do this already, they will look at the masses of unskilled workers who are being paid far too little and ascribe their poverty to some kind of moral failing.
Right.
If only they were better people. Well, if only they worked a little harder.
We've always done that. We've always blamed the poor.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really tired of it.
You're tired of blaming the
poor?
Yeah,
it's pernicious, it's toxic, and it prevents us all from fully experiencing our humanity.
Well,
that sounds a little grandiose, but it's true.
Well, you and I are both in education. The fact of the matter is that we think that one of the panaceas for this situation is to take everybody and give them a good liberal arts education together with technical education.
Yeah, indeed. And also, and capitalism will never recognize this on its own, and you did a good job of pointing this out a few minutes ago. Capitalism will never, for example, look at an individual human life and decide that it has intrinsic worth. The only worth that capitalism ascribes to you or to me is the value it can extract from us in the marketplace. That's
right.
It.
Right.
Capitalism will never look at you or me and say that is a human being with intrinsic work or intrinsic worth who deserves to be happy and healthy and enjoy a certain standard of prosperity such that they don't have to worry about freezing to death or, you know, any of the number of things that beset human beings before we decided to create this thing called civilization. Capitalism is never going to realize that on its own. So the remedy, I think, lies in what you said just now, a broad liberal arts education for everybody, and an imposition of some sort of moral and ethical superstructure onto capitalism such that it acts in the interests of the people instead of against the interests of the people.
Which is why social democracies in, for example, Northern Europe and Scandinavia and other places really make sense. It is a system that doesn't disincentive people to learn how to do new things or create new things or be as creative as they can. But at the same time, it rewards people for being citizens of the state.
Yeah, well, not rewards. Simply acknowledges their basic
humanity.
Well, pays
them off. Pays them off.
That's fine. But see, the problem is, not the problem, actually. Well, the problem here is that we look at those things and we say, oh, that'll never work here. That might be fine for Norway. That might be fine for Sweden. But it'll never work here in the United States. Well, you know what? There is now more social and economic mobility available to a person in Sweden than a person in the United States of America. What does that mean? That means if you're born in Sweden, you have more chance of moving up the socioeconomic ladder than you do if you're born in the United States.
Right. Right. Well, I don't think Americans know that. I think Americans live in a mythological
cave. Where we're the best and no one will ever do things as well as we do.
The way we do, the fact that we don't have a national high-speed rail system and Europe does and Japan does and China is developing one and all that. That's irrelevant because we have a highway system which we essentially created in the interest of General Motors, Firestone Tire, and Standard Oil.
Yeah, and if you don't like it, we'll come kick your ass because we have the biggest military the world has ever seen.
We do. We do. We have a very large military. Trump wants to make bigger, by the way, with new tactical nuclear weapons, and which he talks about using against, right now, Netanyahu is having a love fest with the president, and they're talking about making a war on Iran.
Yeah.
Seriously making a war.
Yeah. So, if you're a young person in the United States right now, your prospects for socioeconomic advancement are slim. The chances that you might be tapped on the shoulder and asked to go fight a foreign war are growing all the time. And if those things don't get you, you might just be shot by one of your fellow citizens who's heavily armed.
Right. Because the gun lobby, which is not a majority of the American people, which is not even a significant minority of the American people, is in a situation where it is pushing guns on people. There are people, I know someone who has 5 automatic or semi-automatic rifles. 5.
But all, let us
how do you, you can only hold
let us
two.
Now
you can only hold two.
Let us now pause and praise the free market for delivering unto us this glorious system in which we live.
Well, it's not a free market.
And let us all now acknowledge that no one can do it any better than we can, and life is worse everywhere on the globe than it is in the United States of America. Hail capitalism!
No, that's you. They can't see you, but you just made a Nazi salute.
Yeah, I did. All right, let's go back to the phones. Francis, good morning.
Hi. Speaking of labor, value of people. You know, while everybody's getting their liberal arts education and student loans, those loans are worth a lot of money, apparently. I watch them, mine being traded around all over the place.
Yeah, it's interesting.
As long as we have those loans, we'll have some kind of value, I guess. But Randy Bryce in Indiana,
uh-huh.
He's an iron worker, union man, who is running as a Democratic nominee. He will be running against Paul Ryan. And I think he has a very good chance of defeating Paul Ryan.
I don't know. Paul Ryan is really good at lifting iron. I mean, you can't. He's got muscles. Sorry, go ahead.
He didn't study his catechism very well. But I was talking to my brother, who's a retired union iron worker also.
Uh-huh.
And we can recall when our father was still alive, and he was a labor leader here in the Northwest. And he was very disappointed in NAFTA. And I think that the president right now is playing to disappointed union workers with his this tariff talk. Although he did kind of back it up a little bit, and he did say that the NAFTA should be renegotiated and be, in addition to being free, be fair to, and he said, to union workers. And did I hear that right? I heard that right.
Well, I don't know if he is. I don't know if he said that or not, but he's such a liar,
right,
Francis? He's such a liar. You can't. Nothing he says is good for more than an hour.
Right, but as far as intelligence goes, I know some very, very brilliant low-income people who choose not to play that game. And the young people today, I think I mentioned this before, I'm very impressed with their critical thinking abilities, and they can see through a whole lot of this stuff. So the next wave of voters may change things back, or at least get us back on track, I hope.
I hope so, too. I really appreciate your call. I also think it's important to understand that right now there are forces at work which may encourage people, ordinary people, not just to get into the street, but to get into the voting booth. But we do have a lot. We have a lot of stuff to do, among which is to go to paper ballots in elections throughout the United States, because that will end the possibility of ballot manipulation to a great extent.
Right, we have paper trails. Yeah.
Yeah, and we have paper trails. Right. Anyway, thank you for the call.
Take care.
You take care.
I was like Frances's calls.
She's a good woman.
She. I don't know if I just, but never mind. All right. Joe writes into the Facebook page, facebook.com/AmyJoe, to say, Joe referred to the decline of labor, which is true in the private sector, though we're in the middle of a historic statewide strike by teachers and school workers in West Virginia. Teachers in Oklahoma are talking about striking too. Let's reinvent our self-fulfilling prophecies around these and not around the negative examples.
I think that's a very important point. I am very dark-minded. I've always suffered from that. I think it's probably a thing that I can treat chemically. However, I choose not to. And I do also think that organized labor has lost its ideological roots. I think we're seeing a resurgence of organized labor with strong ideological roots, only mostly in the public sector, because public sector unions are the only unions that have in the post, Reagan era grown and become important. And I'm proud to say I was involved in public unions for a long, long time, and I thought that the contracts we negotiated were fair and good, and help people have a fair wage. That is not true in many states, and it is not true in many, many, many categories of public workers. This is one of the areas where there should be easily a resurgence of organized labor with an ideological base in the notions of social democracy. I'm not talking communism. I'm not talking socialism. I'm talking about a system that guarantees everybody a living and survivable wage and guarantees everybody certain services which, as citizens, you are entitled to.
Not as citizens, as human beings.
Okay, sure.
All right. All right, Jack writes in the Facebook page to say, many factors, what's missing and what's never discussed, the U.S.'s perpetual war economy.
Yes.
We need to convert to a social economy. Many problems would be solved. It's clear that wars are not defending the citizenry or the Constitution. Wars are advancing the agenda of the global finance oligarchy.
I absolutely agree with that person.
Yeah, I do too.
Good person.
All right, let's go to Lowell. Good morning, Lowell.
Good morning. I would like to introduce another thing that I think is missing from the discussion is the fact that most of the nations we trade with already have a tariff, an essential tariff. It is called a VAT, which is a value-added tax. And every one of the...
which is a sales tax on a sales tax on a sales tax.
Yes, but it operates essentially as a tariff because they drop the VAT for their exports and they add it to their imports.
Yes.
So essentially, they're protecting their national, industries, which in the U.S. we do not do, because our Congress is entirely bought. So you'll notice that not one congressperson talks about a VAT.
Well, I think the discussion of VAT which is a very common thing in Europe, the discussion of VAT is as you say, non-existent. It's essentially a kind of sales tax, but it's a sales tax which is more insidious because at each part of the processing of raw materials, there is a tax added on. And that can come to be quite a significant sum of money. However, those systems are largely internal as opposed to being cross-national.
Correct. But it in effect, protects national industries. And that's where we're at. Just over half the workers in America make less than $30,000 a year.
Right.
I mean, you're looking at, a quarter of the population lives in some form of poverty. So, we can't just say, we're not going to help protect, American workers while making, the folks on Wall Street incredibly rich without any, that's why we used to have, for example, a top marginal tax rate of 90% was to take care of some of that inequality.
Right.
But now, so we have both parties that are doing the same thing. So both parties work for those same Wall Street goons.
Well, I agree with you. And I think that it's really important to understand that we do not have, and we have no perspective to have, a large, again, I'm going to use the word social democratic political movement in the United States, but we may be developing it. I'm seeing it in the impulses of students. I'm seeing it in the impulses of public workers, teachers, and so on. And I'm also seeing it in the regular, old-fashioned, traditional working class. People are wising up, and the question is a question of time. Will people get smart soon enough? They're certainly capable of it, soon enough to avert disaster, or will we find ourselves, because this is the inevitable late-stage capitalist thing, either in a totalitarian state and or a state of constant real war?
Which we appear to already be in, which is...
Well, we are. Late. I mean, look, we got this crazy war in Afghanistan. It goes on and on and on. We did two stupid wars in the Middle East that destabilized the Middle East and produced these huge populations of desperate people who are going to Europe, who in turn put pressure on European governments, who in turn react by becoming, at their populist base, more and more fascist.
Well, but I noticed that we're also bombing five additional countries.
Yes, I didn't mean to exclude that, but yes, you're right.
Which were all listed on that Project for a New American Century list that Bill Kristol did.
Yes,
and Bill Kristol and Dick Cheney and Wolfowitz and a bunch of people.
Right.
So
we need to revisit that.
And we ran out of bombs while we were bombing these countries.
Well, that's terrible. So, I mean, we need to build new bombs. That's obvious. I mean, really.
Hey, well, listen, thank you for the call, Lowell. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I'm glad he brought up the VAT. What is VAT? It's short for value-added tax. one thing that it does, there are arguments for and against the imposition of a value-added tax, but what it does in, on a very important and fundamental level is that it helps account for and mitigate the true cost of manufactured goods. And what do I mean by that? Let's say you buy a widget from someplace.
I only buy left-handed widgets.
And the widgets cost you $1.99. Well, is the true cost of that widget $1.99? The answer is no. There's a whole bunch of invisible costs that go into that, including what natural resources were extracted to make the widget, what pollutants were released into the environment to make the widget, what were any workers injured or killed in the process of making a widget. All of these costs are associated with manufacturing that widget, which in a completely free market would not be accounted for. But the value-added tax does this. And as the fundamental revenue source of a social democratic economy, like France, for example, provides the primary source of revenue for all sorts of essential services for its citizens. So what it does, a value-added tax, is it puts a muzzle on capitalism and forces capitalism to account for the true cost of manufacturing these goods, and it accrues the benefits of that additional revenue back to the people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's an important step to take. So, or something like it.
Well,
if you're talking
like
about,
it, you know,
making capitalism serve everyday
right.
people.
In our system, VAT is very unlikely. There are other ways to raise that money, but we certainly can do it. You know, this conversation really, really is one that should be taking place all over America and be taking place here on KBOO a lot.
Yeah, I would agree.
And it's not happening a lot, even here.
Let's go to Mike. Good morning. Oh, sorry, James. Good morning.
Good morning. The problem that we have today here in America was brought to America by the left when the left turned control of industry over to our central government.
What? I'm not following you here. Help me. Explain what you're saying.
Industry was
James is speaking
to
us from a parallel dimension. It may take him a little bit to organize his thoughts. Go ahead, James.
Under the federal system, the industry was to be owned by the people collectively through the people's authority to tax and regulate industry at the community level.
Well, where does it say that? Where is that in the Constitution or in the law?
Article
or in custom?
Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution limits the role of the central government to a list of enumerated powers. The role of the federal government, the primary role, was to be an ambassador on behalf of the states, which were sovereign entities.
Okay.
You turned control ownership of industry over to the central government when you gave the central government the authority to tax and regulate the people's industry.
The question that Joe put to you, James, was when did we ever have this collectivist ideal that you're talking about? When, in practice or law, did we ever have such a thing?
James, I'm sorry. Right. We've run out of time. Oh, dear. Oh, well. Oh, well.
Well, this has been a really interesting conversation today.
Yeah, and almost touched on the bright.
Almost, yes.
Almost. We came close.
All right, so bring it home for us, Joe. To sum up, why are these tariffs that are so willy-nilly dreamt up by President Trump a bad thing?
Because they will hurt the economies of all the countries involved, those who are being taxed by the tariff, the people of America, because they will be paying that hidden tax in the higher costs of goods and services, and because in the end, it will discourage open trade, which will destroy any pretense of having a fair and just economic system throughout the world.
And it will lead to mass unemployment.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that one.
Which, you know, that's not a real big deal because we have a robust and healthy social safety net in the United States. I'm sure everyone will be just fine.
Right, it'll be okay. We'll get you get you your food basket.
Box. Oh, yeah, with some government cheese.
With a government cheese.
And some canned stuff.
Yeah, canned mystery meat.
Well, I want to thank everybody who called in today. We have the best callers in talk radio. I say that unequivocally. Also, please, if you haven't done so already, go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and throw a few shekels to the KBOO Kickstarter project and help citizen journalists learn to do what they do.
Yeah, because remember, everybody has in their hand a little teeny machine that can be made into a movie and broadcast throughout the world, and you can talk to your friends, and it will be wonderful.
It's miraculous, Joe.
It's miraculous. It's wonderful.
This has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. We'll be back next week.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next on Alternative Radio, environmental activist and feminist Anna Shahnaz Aryan speaks on the Armenians fed up with that country's injustices. At 10, it'll be Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on stage and studio, DeMay features the Third Rail repertory production, Men on Boats, a play about 10 explorers, all played by women. And 11:30 Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews Hannah Piper Burns about her installation Venus Retrograde, based on the TV series The Bachelor. KBOO's Kickstarter is live and nearing the end. We have until Friday to raise the final $6,000. So please go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
KBOO's building a city of media makers. For 50 years, KBOO has had an open-door policy and trained anyone for free who is interested to learn to create radio and media. We believe in mutual aid, a reciprocal exchange of resources and services for benefit of all. What a stale place Portland could become if we lose our diversity of voices and our creative climate that emphasizes fun, truth, beauty, joy, peace, love, and justice. We know that, with our expertise and your support, we can keep the city creative, activated, and aware through the radio.